C1B 1 and 2.
Number 3A.
We were discussing this morning still that fundamental point that it is the idea that is resolving an illusion, and that it is not people that are going to resolve illusions and beliefs, and that this concept is actually coming through in the universe now in every branch of science, and is bringing to humanity of today a completely new concept of what's going on in the world. I showed you that in the line of evolution. Then with Heidegger, I showed it how this history of idea is being seen in philosophy. Now I want to show you also how in the theory of science itself, one begins to realize that it is actually the idea that brings forth science, and not that scientists bring forth a science. This is an insight that comes through more and more, and so that we can see today in a short epitome, so to say, to say that it is not the scientists that make a science, but that it is science that makes a scientist. Again, you have that sense that it is the idea that is always in the realm of established facts in being, that God is a science, that this very idea that God has a science is precipitating itself on humanity and makes people to be scientists. Up to now, one always has believed, really, that it is the scientists that find out a new science and create a new science. First, perhaps it was the mathematicians, then perhaps the physicists, the natural scientists, the medical people, and then came all the many new sciences during the last 100 years. And one had a feeling it was the scientists that were thinking out a new science. But now one begins to realize that it is the very way, that it is the other way round. That would mean the following. It would mean that science does not progress, evolve from the accumulation of knowledge of the scientists. That by accumulating more and more informations, the scientists cannot bring a science further, cannot evolve a science. That is actually not true. One was believing that for a long time. But one begins to realize that science grows through revolutions and not through accumulation of facts. And therefore that book of Kuhn of structure of scientific revolution is showing that very fact, that it is revolutions that bring forth a new science. So we can read in the literature of the theory of science that science does not evolve towards an ideal which we visualize according to its cumulative effect. Science evolves in another way than what we or the scientists can visualize. That therefore science has an own life, and generates itself. Perhaps I just read to you a few short sentences from leading scientists who are philosophizing about the nature of science, like Weizsäcker. He says, "We all know that we do not know where science leads us to. Through science, changes have taken place in our consciousness which demand a completely different way of approaching a subject. We cannot say how a science will evolve." Or Professor Born, he's another Nobel Prize winner, he said, "I believe that science is an institution which goes on irresistibly, and that it would be of no avail if a few people would try to push it into another direction. Again, showing we can't push science into a direction. We can't push science and plan out in which direction, to which goal it is to unfold. Science is stronger than our concept of science, and therefore science itself, the idea of science itself, is leading the scientists. We have that very well-known example from the field of science, from the Max Planck Institute. That's the highest technical institution we know in Germany, compared perhaps with the MIT here in America. And the president of that Max Planck Institute once asked his directors to say what they believe how their research work would unfold within the next 5 years. This document is most instructive. When one analyzes it under the point of view of what has then actually happened, one is surprised to see that all the major and important developments have not been mentioned in this program. They could not be foreseen. This is very typical for the idea of science, that even the best department chiefs of that institute, when they were asked to make a program, a five-year program, how research would unfold, what should be in the line of research, so as to put the means they had into proper use, and that when then that five-year program was over and when they were looking back, they could see that it developed in a completely different way, that all the major revolutions, all the major or important developments could not be foreseen. So it shows that there is an idea at work that is much bigger, much more intelligent than all the intelligence of the scientists. Which means, can you see, that the idea of science makes scientists and not the other way around. That brings me to the new insight that they find in the theory of science, which is putting forward that great question, has science itself a science? It will be at the point of intersection of science as science. Has science itself a science? Well, this question would have been regarded as absolutely stupid only perhaps 20 or 30 years ago. Everybody would have said, don't be silly. It is the scientist that makes science, and science is something very dead. You have to make it in order that it has existence. You have to bring it into existence, and you have to think out that science. And now they begin to see that this is not so. That actually that fourth side of the holy city, which Mrs. Eddy presents as science, is an actuality in being, and that that science itself is aware of itself as science. How can one prove such a thing? And so they show through various developments over the last 100 or so year that it is actually so that there is a genetics in science. Just as biology has somehow a genetic code within the cells, so also science has a genetic code within itself. It generates itself. It is not so that scientists generate science. So they see that there is a genetics of the evolution of science, and that therefore personalities, scientists, play a very subordinate part in that whole thing. We always were thinking that it is that those big research workers who at one point then would find out something terrific after a long period of accumulating data and information, and now one finds out that actually the personality of the scientist is of very minor value. That the development of natural science would have taken place in a similar course, in a similar development, without the great research workers and their personality. Again, as we have seen this morning, it is the idea that seeks out a Jesus. It is the idea that seeks out a Luther or a Mrs. Eddy. So that we can't say if these people would not have been born, if these people would not have been here, the development would have stagnated. That development, they begin to see, would have gone on just the same, perhaps with just a certain temporal or structural shifts, but the trend of the development would have been there just the same, because the idea of science is stronger than the scientists. So that actually the role of the research worker is only that, the role of being transparent. The research worker naturally must have that mentality that is always on the go, that has always the eye on the ball, that always is open for all the information that flow in. He must have an openness of thought. He must naturally also have a fundamental knowledge of the subject, because a new terrific revelation in the field of physics doesn't come to a theologian or to a geometrician. It comes naturally to that mentality which is prepared with some fundamental knowledge, so that the new idea can break in into that fundamental knowledge and restructure it so that the new idea is being born. But it's the idea that restructures it. But naturally the idea must find somehow a structured consciousness, a systematic consciousness, or else it cannot restructure it and bring out a new idea. That's why I feel for us it is so important that we culture ourselves in the system of the divine system of reference. That culturing ourselves in that system and being acquainted with those great categories of being is geared or directed to the purpose that there is somewhere a fundamental system, a fundamental grid within our consciousness, which can be used by the divine idea to bring forth a new idea, which we then call intuition and inspiration. So they say that the research worker or the discoverer are really exchangeable. They are exchangeable. If one is not there, somebody else will be touched by it and will bring forth the new idea. Pasteur said that fortune favors the prepared mind, and you can see only the prepared mind can then be a transparent mind for the influx of the idea. Mrs. Eddy said she had been graciously being prepared through many years for the reception. Can you see? For the reception she received, she didn't think it out, for the reception of this idea, and that it was a gift of grace given unto her. You see? It came from above. She was not thinking it out. She was not inventing Christian Science. She was just willing to be prepared in this science and let the idea use her. They begin to see that the idea of science is of the nature of life, truth, and love. They may not call it with a synonymous term, but the tonality they see is that of life, truth, and love. How? First as life. They begin to see that science in its genesis has the ability to accelerate itself. The acceleration of life, the spontaneity of life, is being shown by the exponential growth of invention, of insights, of discoveries, of inventions. The acceleration that has taken place in a terrific way recently, very much so. You know that there is a terrific knowledge explosion taking place within the last 10, 20, 30 years as never before. The acceleration is also shown that they calculate that if one would number all the scientists that ever lived on this world, one would find that 90% of them, of all the scientists and research workers that have ever been living on this world since time immemorial, that 90% are alive today. And you can see the terrific accumulation of knowledge that is taking place now, and that leads to a terrific explosion of knowledge, and we hardly know how to handle it. So much knowledge is there. We have today the problem that we have too much knowledge, and that things have to be invented twice over and three times over, because the knowledge is not available to everybody. Not everybody has a terrific computer at hand that can give him the information of all that has been discovered during the last 10 or 20 years. And so we have here a sense that science has that idea of multiplication within itself, of infinite fullness within itself, that it doesn't hold back information, but that it gives more information than what we can really accept and digest. But they also see that science has the nature of truth, that the genesis of science has the nature of truth. Namely, they can see that what is being discovered goes along a line that is absolutely logic, meaning that science itself unfolds in a way that has an inner logicity, it has an inner logic. We don't have to put our logic into the development of science, because they can see that the various inventions, discoveries that are made from year to year to year, that they follow an inner law, that they obey an inner law, their own law, and that therefore the development of these inventions show that always one period can stand on the previous period, and that something new is never invented before the prerequisites have not been invented, so that there is never a gap which cannot be bridged, but that every new discovery really relies and stands on the shoulder of the preceding ones, and that the moment inventions are made that are not in the line of the inner logic of truth, that those inventions come to a dead end. And so only the main line, the main trend, has a further unfoldment going up and up and up, so that it is like a stem of a tree that goes up. It may have branches. It can branch out to the right and to the left and find some new inventions, sidelines inventions, but the branches never go further than just so far and no further. And the whole thing that grows is the stem, goes upward and upward towards that goal, towards that telefinalistic aim. Therefore, all faulty discoveries in the law of development, that all those faulty discoveries are eliminated. They come, serve a little purpose, then they are forgotten or are no more used, but the main line, the inner logicity of truth, is going on and on and on. So you can see it would not have been possible for a Newton to come if he couldn't stand on the shoulder of a Kepler, of a Galilei. There would not be possible for an Einstein to come if he couldn't stand on the shoulder of Newton. That after Kepler couldn't come an Einstein, and leaving out Newton, that it wouldn't have made sense. He would have brought a discovery that would not have been understood and could not have been understood. So we feel here that a great inner logicity rules the development of science. Also, you know, it's a very interesting point that one has noticed for quite a while, and which proves really that it's always an idea that is already there in the pre-established realm of harmony that just sits there and waits until the idea finds the right transparency and the right time, both, because one sees that most discoveries that are ever made are always multiple discovery. Multiple discovery means they are discoveries that take place not through one person at a time, but through two and more persons at the same time, without that these people have any contact with one another and know about each other. It's a very common sign and a very common phenomena, I would say, that the great discoveries came always independently to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, up to 8 people, and were presenting the same thing. For instance, you take the differential calculus that came to Leibniz at the same time that it came to Newton, and they didn't know of each other. And so it is that one sees that phenomena over and over, which would mean what? Which would mean that when the time is ripe, then the discovery takes place. And when the time is ripe, it is usually so that the whole atmosphere is pregnant with the expectancy of a solution. And therefore a whole atmosphere, a whole culture is in that state, in that mental state, and therefore is able somehow to receive the new idea. Actually, there are always premature discoveries. Discoveries that come a bit too early, but which have, so to say, a great purpose. Namely, first, to leaven the thought of the age so that the general atmosphere of an age is more and more ready to receive the full influx, the full impact of that discovery. You see that very often in physics, in mathematics, also very often, that one has to rediscover something after 80 years, 60 years, what has been discovered before, but because one has not seen the proper impact of it, the idea just didn't go through, didn't really leaven the whole consciousness of the whole world. It may be that Mrs. Eddy's discovery was a premature one. It's now already over 100 years ago, and it hasn't been able to infiltrate world consciousness. On the contrary, it seems that it fiddles out more and more. So it may be a premature discovery. That's why she said it may take 2 or 3 centuries for a discovery to be seen and understood and accepted. There are various prophecies she makes in this regard, which prophecies which are usually disregarded by the field because they don't like to see the truth about it. You have those wonderful prophecies of Mrs. Eddy that something would happen in 1936, that something would happen in the 1950s, and all this is just negated because they can't see the new child. So we have that point two, which says that the new idea must also have the right time to come forth. The time must be right. And therefore, there is nothing more powerful, that's one saying, nothing more powerful than the right idea at the right time. And so, therefore, those who are nurturing a premature idea, premature discovery, naturally must be aware of that and not give up and not be disillusioned and not be discouraged of the present state of things.